In this final hour of the programme, an in-depth interview with pianist Ivan Illich, who I caught up with while he was in Hong Kong on holiday. And while he was here, he even managed to take in the Hong Kong Philharmonic Orchestra's Symphony Under the Stars concert. We had a long chat. Ivan's first CD of music by Debussy, lauded as masterly by Gramophone magazine, received Mezzo Television's Critics' Choice Award in France and was selected by Fanfare magazine as a top five CD of 2009. He's going to be talking about that CD and more. So first, tell me about your roots.
Okay. I was born in California to immigrant parents, to Yugoslav parents, I should say. I was about to say Serbian, but of course, that wasn't the case at that point.
Was 1978.
That's right, 1978. And my parents had been living in the States for a number of years. My parents had studied there and decided to settle permanently. But they still have a very strong connection to this day to Serbia, and I speak the language fluently, and I return several times a year. And I think that the choice of career is very much linked to the fact that when I was a child, I would go to concerts in Serbia, Yugoslavia at the time, of the young bright stars, and the amount of talent there and the encouragement they receive is something that's quite exceptional, and I think that maybe still only exists in countries like Eastern Europe.
Talking about your time in the States, you began your piano playing there.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I took private lessons like many middle-class people, I guess you could say. It's one of those activities that parents like to foist upon their children to build discipline and also as a way of introducing them to cultural activities, which I think is a wonderful thing. And I was one of the rare people that actually ended up making a career of it. It's funny, the number of people I run into when I tell them what I do for a living, they say, oh, I took piano lessons for 3 or 4 years, and then I let go of it. How did you manage to stay with it? And I think it's like anything else. You have to do it because you love to do it. And like many people, I took a year off when I was an adolescent. I was difficult. I wanted to do other things. But my love for the music was the most important thing. And that's why I continue to play every day to this day.
And with your parents' encouragement, were they knowledgeable about music themselves? Or was it just something that they wanted you to do because it was the done thing with middle-class families?
I think I might have been a mixture of both. But I have to say that there was an auspicious beginning. My parents' first date was at the Symphony in Belgrade. And they both have always loved going to concerts. They both have studied music in a kind of a pedestrian level, but there's a definite real appreciation there. And to this day, my parents go to the opera together and to the ballet, and they don't do that just to make me happy. They do it because they love it. So I think that made a big difference. There was kind of a respect for the arts in my household, which I think is not the case in every household. Some parents, you know, some fathers would rather watch the football game on television, or some mothers would rather go out with their friends shopping. My parents, definitely part of their together time as a couple throughout their lives has been going to cultural events. And so that gave it a kind of a certain weight in our family. And it made it so that when I chose the career, it wasn't that difficult. I knew that I would have the respect and the encouragement of my parents. Very important.
And do they attend your recitals?
They do, although it makes me very nervous when they do. And I much prefer when they don't come. So I try to avoid playing in any city they will be in. And if they are in Serbia or in California, I try to schedule my concert dates in the opposite times of the year. But once a year or so, they do hear me. And of course, it's very gratifying to send them my newest CD and to have them tell me that they listen to it in the car and that kind of thing. It's probably the most gratifying part of my career.
What was the first piece that you ever played that you found great difficulty with that you've now mastered?
That's an excellent question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that. I would say that one of the really difficult pieces that I learned much too early was Maple Leaf Rag by Scott Joplin. And there are two things about that. First of all, it is a very virtuous piece, and it's not the kind of thing you're supposed to learn when you're a beginner. So I think it is a good thing in general to learn things that are too difficult for you. There are two schools of thought, one saying that you have to master something perfectly and then move on. But I think that it's good to build an ambition in a student and have them want to do things that are too difficult because it gives them motivation to practice. And second of all, it was typical of my musical education that I had a teacher that was very open-minded and let me play whatever it is I wanted to play as long as I kept with it. And I think that it is a mistake when you try to have students play things that will improve their capabilities, serious music like Bach that maybe they don't like as much, versus playing something that might be kind of considered popular music, but makes it so that they're motivated to stay with music and to practice every day. So I know that with my own development early on, the first 3 or 4 years, I did study the classics, Mozart, Bach, Czerny, things like that. But also I was able to play music from, I remember there was an anthology called Piano Showstoppers or something like that. And I think that's wonderful because some of those Henry Mancini melodies made me want to sit at the piano for half an hour versus 15 minutes. And that kind of thing really early on, you know, makes a huge difference.
While you were developing at the piano, who would you say your favorite composer was to play?
I would say that Bach was extremely important for me in my early development because Bach can be played in so many different ways and sound good. And so it was very important to me to get to a level where if I was playing the correct notes, the music would sound good. I didn't have the developed ear enough to realize the difference between my interpretation and the recordings I was listening to. And so I guess that I would say that with Bach, I could get closest to what I wanted faster. And also, I've studied math as in my university studies. I've always had a strong affinity towards music where the structure is important and evident. And so even before I, my personality was completely developed, I was definitely drawn towards things like Bach, where the structure is important, where there's a certain kind of balance between the two hands, you know, symmetry, all those kinds of things. I think that I noticed without really being conscious of it.
So you're at the University of California, Berkeley, and you're studying music and mathematics. And then all of a sudden you find yourself in Paris.
Well, first, it was a difficult decision to make to choose music over mathematics, primarily because I realized that if I wanted to become really good at one thing, I'd have to do only one thing. And that's something that you learn the hard way. In other words, I was doing both. I was quite devoted to both music and mathematics. They're very different subjects, obviously. There are some connections. I think that there are people that tend to like both. But at one point, I guess it was a challenge for myself. I remember I have a friend in high school who was a very talented tennis player, and he ended up being ranked nationally in America. And he used to tell me, aren't you ever sick of just being talented at something? Don't you ever want to really become professional at something? Because he always had this focus very early on. And that really got to me. I have to say, over the years, I thought to myself, I can allow myself to do several things. But at one point, I realized that if I really wanted to be the best that I could be, I had to just stop everything else. And because I have a very active curiosity about many subjects, it takes a real effort for me to just focus on one thing. But luckily, I managed to do that. So I decided to apply to a scholarship from the university, which was a very prestigious one. They give it out once a year to a music student. And the student can choose a project anywhere in the world as long as he is not enrolled in a institution. So, for example, my project was to study with a Lebanese teacher in Paris, who I'd found out about over the years. And he was kind of like my idol at that point. He'd recorded a Scriabin CD, which was amazing. Billy 80 is his name. And I wanted to do everything in my power to go to Paris to study with him, just to see how he managed to get that sound out of the piano. And at that point, I decided when I won the scholarship that I was going to go to Paris and just drop everything else, practice all day, stop doing sports, stop doing all kinds of things that, you know, kind of nourished my life, and just become kind of a pianistic robot, which is not necessarily what I wanted to be in the end, but I knew that it was something, a phase that I had to go by.
You already mentioned one of your teachers, but there were others.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So in Paris, there are kind of a few mythic teachers, of one of which is Jacques Rouvier, who has studied. He's taught many of the very well-known pianists of today, like Alain Grimaud and kind of all kinds of stars. But there was somebody else that was just as important when I was at the end of my studies, named François-René Duchâble. And Duchâble is more well-known as a pianist than as a pedagogue. And I had kind of a random opportunity to take a few lessons with him because I saw a brochure advertising lessons in Annecy, which is on the Swiss border. you know, you've never heard of a music school in Annecy. But anyway, it turns out that he had a house there and he would give master courses there once a year and no one knew about it in Paris. And I just went down on a lark and I was the only student there. So I had 4-hour lessons with him and we built this really interesting bond. And there were a couple of things that were very important to me about that experience, in particular, the fact that he considered me as a peer. He spoke to me with, you know, using the respectful vous in French. He would give me the choice. He wouldn't say, you must do it this way. He would say, what do you think? What is the best way to do it? And then I would make a strong choice and he would say, okay, that's not what I would have chosen, but that's totally respectable. And it made me feel like my own choices had worth. Whereas in France, the normal pedagogy is to kind of crush the student and say, you know, you don't know anything, get them to really be humble. Whereas maybe he sensed that that wasn't a problem with me. I'm always very self-critical, so I don't need criticism from the outside in order to keep myself in check. But another thing is that he is extremely eccentric personality. And I think that working in the arts, you have to allow yourself certain eccentricities. You have to allow yourself to be different. There is nothing worse than conformism in the arts, to have everyone be the same. And if there's one thing, aesthetically speaking, that I think was a big mistake in the second half of the 20th century in music, it's that we tried to move in the direction of something that was neutral. Everyone wanted to play just what was written on the score and nothing else. Everyone wanted to pretend that musicians have no personality, nothing of their own to add. And of course, they were all doing it all along, but they pretended in their interviews and so forth that their biggest goal was to just get as close as possible to the original intention of the composer. But I think that there's something a little bit dishonest about that, because if that were true, we would just plug the notes into a computer and have them played perfectly. Obviously, I'm doing a caricature, but to argue that the person who's performing the music does not have the right to have their own opinion, I think is going way too far in one direction. So it's somewhat ironic that Glenn Gould was such a huge figure in the interpretive world in 20th century, and yet he was so eccentric. And I think that François-René Duchâble, he made me feel like I had the right to make strong choices and to be my own person. And certainly he has done that. And what's wonderful about him is that I don't want to be like him in the sense that I don't want to play like him or say the things that he says, but I want to be have as a strong identity, I suppose. I want to have my stamp. I want to have people listen to my recordings and recognize me. I think that's kind of the ultimate compliment.
We've just heard the worldwide radio premiere of the Chopin-Godowsky Etude No. 2 in D-flat, Triumph, played by Ivan Illich. And you heard it here first on Sunday Morning on 4. And now, more of my one-on-one with the pianist. I read somewhere that you were very influenced by Ivo Pogorelich. Now, why is that? Is he terribly eccentric or not?
He is. I'm not sure that I'm necessarily drawn to his eccentricities, but first of all, it's a cultural thing. I was brought up on his records because in Yugoslavia, he is considered kind of like a god in, musically. You know, that can be argued for and against. But certainly, some of his recordings, the Bach, the Scarlatti, the Haydn, the Schumann that he made early on in his career, have a certain vitality. There's an energy. It's not so much that he's making interesting interpretive choices, it's that there's this kind of tension. It sounds like someone who had just had 10 cups of coffee and is playing and can really play at that tempo. And I just find that riveting. I mean, I listen to the recordings and my pulse races. And I've listened to them hundreds of times and I still get excited. And I guess I don't know if my gift is to play and make people's pulse race, but I want them to listen the way that I listen to him.
What performance of yours would you say brought you to the attention of the international musical community? Or perhaps it was a recording. I don't know.
I would say that I've been performing internationally since about 2003, 2004. But I think that the Debussy recording of 24 Preludes that was released first in 2008 has been a huge milestone in my career. At that point, I played in Carnegie Hall. I played at Wigmore Hall in London. Major halls in other cities as well. And also there was a certain amount of attention given to it by the press, specialized magazines, I guess throughout the world really, and it was played on radio stations all over the place. So that was really gratifying to me to receive emails from radio stations all over the world, sometimes in languages I didn't understand, to tell me that they were broadcasting the CD and what time and could I listen in. And sometimes I would over the internet streaming. And it was just an amazing feeling to hear my disc being talked about in Dutch and, you know, for like an hour, let's say. That was really something for me. So I think that made a big difference also because the Debussy Preludes are something that have been recorded lots and lots of times now. There are wonderful recordings that everyone refers back to, notably Christian Zimmermann's for Deutsche Grammophon and Walter Gieseking also made a very famous version. But I played it in a way, I think, which was unusual in the sense that Debussy can be kind of syrupy sometimes and people play it with no rhythm and it becomes kind of this quote-unquote impressionistic slop, really for lack of a better word. And having gone through the French school system, I know that in France people don't consider French music to be impressionistic, it's just normal music. And so they play it the way they would play anything else, Mozart or Ravel or Bach or anything else. So I think that I respected the rhythmic aspect of the music much more. That was what I was trying to do. Whether I succeeded or not is under discussion currently. But I feel quite confident that I did. And so I made my mark on that music, I think. If you compare my CD with others, they don't sound the same. You might not like it, you might like it, but it's different. And I think that someone defending French music who is not French and putting it, you know, really launching their career with that, relaunching, I guess, was a serious statement to make. And I think that was really important for building my identity abroad. Mm-hmm. So I still play Debussy very, very often when I tour, and it's something I feel extremely comfortable with. I can start concerts with it. I can play an entire second half of it. I can pretty much wake up in the middle of the night and play Debussy. And it's nice to have something where you feel that comfortable, where it's really, you know, you can be yourself, I suppose.
Would it be fair to say that you play Debussy differently because you have lived in France, in Paris, and perhaps you might have played it in another way had you never lived in Paris?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I agree with that wholeheartedly. I have a recording of myself playing a few of the preludes when I was still a student, and it's incredible to listen to those recordings now. It's so different. My conception of French music is so different. And I think the main thing is that there's kind of a culture, a byword in French culture in general, which is moderation in all things, which goes back to kind of the Greek model, I would say, of aesthetics. And I think that's a very important thing that people ignore often. People who haven't been to France or don't speak the language or don't know much about the culture, you know, in depth, I would say. You can't play things too fast, too slow, too loud, or too soft. It always has to be in moderation. And if it wasn't for my experience in France, I wouldn't know that to the point that I know it now. And as a result, it's not so much that I did that, it's that I knew to react against it. And I knew that it was a point of departure. Whereas some recordings I've heard, some of which are wonderful and some of which are less wonderful, people do whatever they want with the music. They just kind of shape it wherever they want. There's a wonderful recording of French music by a Czech pianist named Ivan Morovic. And he has some of the most astonishing versions of Debussy preludes I've ever heard. There are four on this one record recorded in New York in 1960, I think. And he definitely does not use that point of reference, and it's gorgeous. And then there's Angela Hewitt, a Canadian pianist, who recorded Ravel, and her stuff is just really bizarre. I mean, it doesn't seem like there's any frame of reference whatsoever, and it seems to me stylistically inappropriate, I would say. So, French music to me, it kind of feels like my own heritage now. I would not treat it with what I see as kind of a disrespect that I hear in some other recordings. So definitely the fact that I live in France and that I am becoming French has a huge influence on the way I play this music and the fact that I take it so seriously.
We've just heard Ivan Illich with Debussy's The Hills of Anna Capri. Now, you mentioned the Debussy recording. That wasn't your first. Mm. The first was actually sponsored by the city of Paris.
That's right, yeah. And it was wonderful because in this first experience in the recording studio, professionally speaking. I had a fantastic sound engineer, an artistic director. I had everything I needed, a wonderful piano. And this is before I could really appreciate it. Now, almost 10 years later, I realized the luck I had, really, that I was making a real, you know, that the sound on the recording is as good as anything I'm doing now. And again, it was kind of like my experience with my last pedagogue, Duchamp. It was just people appreciating that I had something to say and that I was good enough to do it, really. So they were taking me seriously. And it was really, really important for me at that point. And that CD has been hugely important. It was what allowed me to play most of my concerts early on. If I didn't have that CD, you know, I could have sent my CV, but I think that I would not have had as much success as I did early on.
Let's talk about your latest project, which is the Chopin Gudovsky Etudes.
Yeah, it's been a fascination of mine. I suppose that one of the things that performers do usually early on in their career is they try to pick a repertoire that's kind of unusual and make a case for it. And I've been doing that on several levels, and I've become much more involved with it than I thought I would be. This has been almost a two-year project now. And it originally started because I heard that there were versions of the Revolutionary Etude for one hand, and I just couldn't believe that that was true. And so I dug up the music online. Of course, via Wikipedia now, you can access almost anything for free. And I downloaded the scores, and they just looked impossible. So I started with Chopin's third etude, very well known, called Tristesse. That's the kind of the nickname for the piece. And I started to play it with one hand, with the left hand. And I felt so awkward, and I couldn't believe that here I was, a pianist with over 25 years of experience, and I felt like a beginner. And it just intrigued me. I felt my thumb felt like I was playing with my foot. I mean, it was just incredible. But working at it, and I just kept at it, I got to a point where I became really comfortable playing this. And it reminded me of an experience I had. My first concerto I ever played with orchestra when I was 20 was the Ravel concerto for the left hand. And it was a really important thing for me, playing this concerto. And I felt really confident about the way I was playing it. And I still have the recording, and half of it's terrible, but half of it's not that bad. So I became interested in this idea that the repertoire for the piano is almost exclusively right hand heavy. That is to say, if you look at, for example, Chopin, all of Chopin, who is probably the most important composer for piano, the most influential, I would say, 90% of the notes are happening in the right hand. And the left hand has almost nothing to do in most of the music. And I came to that realization when I played the Gudovsky. I thought to myself, how is it possible that my left hand is this weak? I've been playing for this long. I've been giving concerts, I've been doing recordings, and I'm realizing that my left hand is really awkward. And I realized, I looked back at all the Chopin, and I realized that it was completely unbalanced. So I thought to myself, this is something I can really improve in myself. And I started learning a few of the Chopin Gudovsky for the left hand, and I learned all of them in the end. And it took me so long, and I sweated so much blood that if I'd known how difficult it would have been at the beginning, I never would have done it. But now I've been playing these pieces in concerts, and people love them, and no one ever plays them. And I think it's not just because they're so difficult. I think it's because no one's really made a case for them yet and has said, look, you know, this is really worthwhile. So now I do fun things like I'll play recitals, and I'll turn the piano around so people can't see that I'm playing with one hand. And then I'll announce at the end of the concert that I did. And as an encore, I'll play one of them, and people will just be astonished. And I just have so much fun with that, because there are people who have never been to recitals before, and they see that, and they just think it's so much fun, and they talk about it afterwards, and they're excited, and it's just wonderful for me.
We've just heard another worldwide radio premiere of the Chopin-Gadowski Etude No. 43 in C sharp minor, Whirlwind, played by Ivan Illich. And now for the final part of my interview with the pianist. Let's talk about the project that you're currently working on.
Yeah. This is something that it's strange for me to talk about a project when I'm in the middle of it like this. I tend to be quite superstitious. I like to talk about things when they're done. And I think that I'm not alone as a musician in doing that. The next project is something, obviously, when one plays a piece, one interprets it. And I've been fascinated by the fact that Gadowski interpreted Chopin's etudes and the way he did it. He transcribed them for left hand and he changed them completely in certain cases. And no one else, to my knowledge, has really done that. People transcribe pieces, but they don't really co-compose. I call it kind of co-composition. It's as if they wrote the pieces together, even though Chopin died 30 years before Gadowski was born. And so I've been trying to interpret the process, if that makes sense. In other words, instead of interpreting a piece like a Beethoven sonata, I'm interpreting the idea of what Gadowski did. So now I'm doing my own transcriptions where I change the pieces completely. And these are French melody. These are art songs, kind of like German Lieder, except they're the French versions. They're quite unknown. There are songs by Ravel, by Debussy, by Fauré, which are more well-known. And then there are their predecessors, like Henri Duparc, Ernest Chausson, Berlioz, other people like that, have written wonderful songs that are never, ever played. And the piano parts are stunningly beautiful. And as a result, I started transcribing when I was in a residency in Rome earlier this year, and I thought it would be fun to try to do it for one hand, the same way Gadowski did, to see what it felt like, to see why he would do that. Because everyone asks me, why did he do that? And I have no idea. There is no clue in his letters. But it turns out that when you do it yourself, you realize that when you give up the right hand, you gain something. And I think that that something is you gain a control of the resonance. You gain control of the pedal. And also, you can't play things as quickly with one hand. So you have to take time. You have to breathe more. In some ways, it's more sensual to do it with one hand. It's unusual to say it that way, but I really believe that it's true. And so I've already done 7 transcriptions of French song, which will be about a third of a CD, and I plan to do the rest in the coming months, and that will be the following CD. And this is even further in the direction of becoming, I guess, eccentric and doing something unusual, but it also is tied to something I'm interested in, which is composition. And one of the things that non-musicians always ask me is, isn't it boring to play the same pieces with the same notes and not write them yourself? And that comment used to make me really angry. But on the other hand, there's some truth to it, because there is something a little bit robotic, as one of the composer friends of mine says, about just playing things the way they're written. But there are certain pieces where actually some things don't work that well. And if you make slight tweaks, they work better. And no one's the wiser. There's almost no one that ever notices these things except other musicians. So I find that intriguing. And I think that as long as you're upfront about it, you know, I don't call these pieces transcriptions. I call them something else. I don't know what I'm going to call them yet. But I put my name on them because I admit the fact that I'm changing them. And when you change the pieces, you put your stamp on them. There's no better way to do that. You're saying, this is mine. You know, you like it or you don't, but I'm taking responsibility. And I think that's a fascinating idea for me.
Thank you.
That has not even been recorded for commercial release yet, so an absolute first for you. We've been listening to Ivan Illich's version of Chausson's Canticle to My Spouse. Now, Ivan Illich's CDs of Debussy and the Chopin-Godowsky Preludes will be available in Hong Kong from March, and you can find out more at ivancdg.com. And to end Sunday Morning On for this week, we'll be listening to two more of Debussy's Preludes now, played by Ivan Illich, Footprints in the Snow and The Wine Gate.
Thank you.
We've been listening to Footprints in the Snow and The Wine Gate by Debussy, played by Ivan Illich. And that's all for this week's Sunday Morning on 4. Thanks for joining me. Hope you've enjoyed it. If you missed any of it and you'd like to catch up, then you can do so at rthk.hk. Go to the Radio 4 homepage and there you'll find the program archive and just look up Sunday Morning on 4 and today's date. It's the 30th of January. Today's Art Tidbit is next, and for now, from me, Stacey Rodder, bye-bye.
Art Tidbit
艺术焦点
今日要为你介绍一下一套新推出的贝多芬钢琴奏鸣曲全集的录音。钢琴家罗提 Louis Lotti 在这一套九张唱片里面弹奏了贝多芬全部32首奏鸣曲，其实大部分都是旧录音来的，八首就是新冠录，另外还加插了一首 D 大调钢琴四手联弹奏鸣曲，是罗提和梅西亚合作演出的。贝多芬的奏鸣曲被人誉为钢琴曲目当中的新约圣经，罗提亦都曾经在访问里面讲到他对贝多芬作品的看法。罗提觉得贝多芬的音乐有着微妙逼人的动力，其中一个原因可能就是音乐素材简单而集中，每个乐章都是由少量的乐师建构出来的，他能够尽用乐师赋予大胆的速度和强度的变化。现在我们就听下罗提灌录的32首奏鸣曲里面最后的一首编号111当中的选段。我是万盈盈，你收听的是第四台的艺术焦点。